Hello and welcome to Authentic Messengers. My name is Catherine Van Wetter and I will be your host today. Every Tuesday at 3 p.m. Pacific Time, I will be interviewing different authors from our new book, Life Sparks. All of these interviews will be archived, so if you miss one, you can go to www.blogtalk/authenticmessengers.com. Please also visit us on our Facebook page, Authentic Messengers. Thank you so much for joining us today. Today I will be interviewing Petra Nicole. Petra holds a BA in business. She studied psychology and art in London at Hampstead College and is a certified Reiki master teacher in the UC, pardon me if I didn't pronounce that right, tradition, and has taught Reiki and emotional processing to over 3,500 students worldwide. As an author, certified life coach, entrepreneur, and wellness coach, she has facilitated workshops with positive, sustainable transformations in individuals for over 30 years. Her passions center around health coaching that incorporate the mind, body, and spirit. Petra teaches people simple ways to clear unresolved emotional issues through golden light meditation, healthy eating, preventative care of body and mind, advising use of therapeutic grade essential oils to live healthier, more fulfilling lives. Welcome. Thank you for joining me today.
Thank you for inviting me. Thank you, Catherine.
So I'm really excited about opening up and talking to you about how it is that you got involved in Life Sparks and the name of your chapter that you'll be offering us. And then we'll start going into some wonderful questions and answers and making this a very nice dialogue where we can spend the next 50 minutes together. So tell me, please, the name of your chapter. What is the name of your chapter?
It's called Comatose, and it was actually a chapter out of my book, Pit Ashes, A Transcendental Journey. About a few, maybe 2 months ago, I met Tammy Blodgett, and she told me about this book that she's launching with 20 authors and inspiring stories that illuminate the soul. And I thought, wow, that would be fantastic to be a part of that, and submitted a few stories. And they chose Comatose, and it was really an event in my life that changed my life forever. And just from the name, you can probably gather that it has something to do with a coma. So,
yes. So can you talk a little bit? It's very intriguing with the title. Can you tell us what the title means to you and what the readers can expect?
Comatose was an event. I was a very sick little kid in Bavaria growing up in Germany, and I wasn't listening to my mom like so many of us do, and I had a horrible cold and decided to spend the night with my aunt in her new apartment. And I remember shivers running down my spine and feeling super, super cold and chilled. And the next day my aunt dropped me off at my house, and my mother was not happy, so she bundled me up on the couch and gave me some medicine. And in the time between my mom and my brother running an errand in town, it was a very snowy, snowy day, they came back and found me basically dead under the coffee table and rushed me to a hospital. And it was an amazing event for me. I had a near-death experience that I had to keep hidden from everyone for a very long time. So it was really exciting to write about it. I felt writing my memoir was like doing shadow work. You know, you have to go into some of the deepest parts of your soul to talk about these things. So.
Wow, it's interesting because so much of near-death experience is starting to come to the forefront now, so I really appreciate your courage and your transparency of being able to talk about something, especially as such a young child, and to finally bring the truth of what happened to the surface. Can you tell me a little bit of where it was that you grew up and what kind of family you grew up in, so that the listeners can become more familiar as to why or how it may have been difficult for you to have talked about this episode?
Well, I was I grew up in a little village outside of Munich, Germany, and it was predominantly Catholic. And so we were a middle-class Catholic family, very sheltered, lots of relatives, lots of events, lots of socialization. I mean, I could ride my bike to my grandfather and grandmother's house, and you know, we had just a very tight-knit family. My father was an atheist, which was really interesting, and my mother in Bavaria at that time when I was growing up, I was born in 61, and so, you know, throughout my childhood, religion or the Catholic Church sort of was just part of everything. I mean, it wove through everything that was going on in our social life, and so many Catholic holidays and so much, you know, church going and celebrations that revolved around Catholicism, which I still find so interesting to this day. And we had a business. My parents had a business, and I had a brother who was a year and a half older than me. And I was one of those little kids that was always, everybody said, "Oh, Petra, you're just so naive." I was so innocent, so naive. I believed everything that anybody told me. So I remember my little friend who tried to sell me a glass button and told me it was a diamond, and I ran home all excited to my mother and told her I had found this diamond. So,
how did she treat you when you talked about finding the diamond? Did she support you, or did she? Because sometimes when you bring little treasures home like that, you know, sometimes parents can make a child feel silly that they said it, or they get supported. Mm-hmm. How did your mother treat you when you mentioned that?
My mother and I were super close. She was very, very close to me and very supportive. It was my brother who was the other way. Oh my God, it's just a glass button, Petra. It's not a diamond. I was just crushed.
It's something when you find such a precious little jewel and then something like that happens. Wow. So the relationship that you had with your brother then, was it strained? And 'cause you alluded a little bit to that.
Yes, my brother and my father didn't get along very well. So whenever I was praised, I had to also reap the repercussions of that. You know, it's like sitting straight and eating very nicely, or him slurping his soup or something like that. So there was always a little bit of envy, I think, on his part toward me. And it had to do with his relationship with my father. And I went into that in more detail in my book, in different chapters of my book. And I am just very, very excited to be part of Life Sparks, because I think it is just such an incredible opportunity for people to get their stories out and to really go through the process of writing. This is therapy in itself, and you are a writer also. So I really appreciate that you're doing the interview. So thank you for having me on your show.
Oh, it's a pleasure, and I've done radio for many years, and it's always such an honor to have a dialogue like this, you know, in order for others to be able to learn from us, and, you know, especially in the areas that we may have hidden away that so many people may have experienced, such as your near-death experience. So you mentioned earlier that you were on the ceiling when you were very sick. What happened when you were on the ceiling?
Well, they packed me into a car and rushed me to this little hospital, Deinheuring, a Kinderkrankenhaus. And when we got there, I was looking down at my body from the ceiling and saw myself and realized that they couldn't see me. And it was really interesting because my father was, I could feel my father's emotions and I could feel everything my mother was feeling and the doctors were feeling. It was as if I could simultaneously just jump into everybody's body for a second and feel what they were feeling. And I was connected to all of the things that were going on. And I looked down and I tried to call out to my father, "Don't cry, puppy, don't cry. I am up here. I'm okay. I'm okay." And then I flew along the corridors of the hospital and saw my mother sitting outside. And I remember her wearing her fox coat and she was signing a document for the surgeons to do surgery, obviously, on me. And she was just as white as a ghost, and I could feel her absolute dread and despair in her body. And that really was hard to move through emotionally. And then right after that, I was drawn into this light. There was like a cloud tunnel, and there was bright, bright white light, and I was sort of like sucked through that tunnel like a speed of light. I didn't have time to think about anything because there were no thoughts. I just came out on the other end of this bright, bright light tunnel of clouds and found myself in this gigantic library that never ended. I looked up and there were books and books and floors and floors and floors of books, endless books. And it was absolutely fantastic and amazing. And I heard this humming sound that I will never forget, because I heard that humming sound later in my life again and again and again. And so I was very grateful that I felt like this was some sort of an initiation, really, for my soul.
Wow. So the humming sound, was it like the humming of angels, or do you have a sense of what the humming was?
It was like a humming, like an oming almost, but you couldn't really make out the om sound, but it was sort of that Tibetan chime humming sound. And
yes,
it felt very weightless and very, very loving. And I felt there was no more gravity, so I didn't really have a body, even though I felt completely present in my body. It was a very interesting feeling. And I saw in the distance these men, these elders, standing in a circle talking, or not talking, because they weren't really moving their mouths. And the second I saw them, I found these people, and then I immediately wanted to be with them, and then somehow I was transported right away towards them. So that was fantastic. Then I stood with them and recognized one particular man who was wearing a whitish sort of long gown, or, you know, like the Franciscan monks would wear in the monasteries. And the other men were standing around with long beards. But this particular one, he looked a lot like the pictures or paintings in the galleries of depictions of Jesus.
Wow.
And his eyes were so blue, so bright blue, that it was almost blinding to look into his eyes. They were that blue. And I felt as if laser beams of love just shot into my heart every time he gazed at me. I felt infused with this amazing, amazing love. So,
what an amazing gift, especially as someone so young. What was your sense? Did they speak to you, or did you want to stay there and not come back, or what was your experience?
Yeah, absolutely. I did not want to go back. That's a good question. We communicated telepathically, and I immediately said, "I'm not going back. I'm not going back." So the idea was, we were all one with our thoughts. Somehow we were all connected, and I knew them. They were so familiar, so familiar. And I felt completely one with them. And the one with the really long beard, and he was kind of chubby, he had his big leather-bound tethered book in his hand. and he was looking at it. It was open, and he held it with both arms out, or both hands out, and he was looking into the book. So now I understand later in my life, I studied meditation for 11 years and realized, oh, that must have been the Akashic Record where I ended up in this big library. And
wow.
He was looking for some data about my soul consciousness, or where are we going to send her now, you know. He felt like they were making a decision, but everything was very jolly, very happy. So it wasn't sad or serious at all. It was very lighthearted, like, oh, what are we going to do with Petra? What are we going to do with her? Kind of response to me. And I definitely did not want to go back in my body.
Wow. What an experience, because I, you know, being so young as you were, I know that oftentimes we still have that connection to where we came from. There may still be that slight memory of where we've come from. And so to be up in that place where there was so much love, and your feelings, it sounds like, were so nurtured and taken care of. The thought of coming back, now what? Coming back, what was it like when you actually did come back? Did they gently bring you back down, or did you just find yourself in the hospital, or what do you remember?
Well, I woke up in a hospital in the Steinhöring, a kindergarten house. I woke up in this room that was at least 1,500 square foot room with a wooden floor and smelled like iodine. And I looked to my right, and there was a little two-year-old boy who had this strange mushroom growth all over his mouth. And I immediately closed my eyes because I didn't want to see that. And then I heard a door open, and it was as if it was like in the old castles in Munich in Bavaria. There are these really, really heavy doors, and when you open them, you can feel the heaviness of the door and the wood, and the, you know, they just they creak and they make a lot of noise. And I heard two people walking in, and that was my aunt and my mother walking towards me. And my mother kissed me on the forehead and stroked my head and said to my aunt, if she had died, she's so lucky to have survived. I could have not lived without her. And I remember, I couldn't open my eyes, or I couldn't talk anymore. It was as if suddenly I was transported back into that humming sound, and that same love energy was all around me and enveloped me. And then it was really interesting. Later in my life, I realized that I never had any recall from anything that happened in the hospital for the 2 weeks that I was there recovering. And I could not remember one single event in that hospital from the moment my mother and aunt arrived. That was the only time I have any memory of waking up until I came home 2 weeks later. And everything was different, because I realized, you know, as a 9-year-old, obviously you can't make sense of what exactly happened, and it's really bizarre to go through this experience of seeing your body on the scene, you know, seeing yourself on a hospital bed, but yet you are, you know, in a different place. So those connections are really hard to make when you're really that young. And later I had to put the pieces together. So, yeah.
And even when you're older, you know, those are difficult experiences to piece together. Were you treated differently after this by your family?
Oh, yeah. My brother thought I was really weird, but I think he always thought I was weird. And my family and my friends always thought that I was a strange spiritual person that was landing in their family like a little alien that didn't really belong. But my mother, go ahead.
Well, I hear your laughter, and you know, it's something when, for those of us that hadn't really felt that we belonged in our home, you know, that can really create some confusion and discord, you know, because we can cover it up with laughing and thinking how weird we are, yet, you know, in our hearts, it can sometimes be difficult to know where our place is, and having experienced such a profound experience, such as what you did as a child. I mean, what a sacred adventure you went on. So just curious of, you know, how did it, with you not feeling like you were part of your family, did you find ways to kind of shake it off so that you felt like you were more of the family, or did you continue being who you were, the sweet, innocent one?
Well, I tried to approach my mother about telling her what happened and what I had seen. And one day, maybe, you know, 4 weeks later, she was changing the sheets in the bedroom, and I said to her that I went into this tunnel, and that I saw Jesus, and I wanted to tell her everything I had felt and how strange it was, and that I was still hearing that humming sound. That strange humming sound is always around me. And she put her index finger on my lips and said, "Petra, we will never talk about this again. Little girls don't see Jesus, and if you talk about it, they will put you in an insane asylum."
Wow. So that was something that you pushed underground. How did that affect the way you lived your life then? Did you just... And I apologize if I'm asking things that are difficult to answer. I'm certainly not wanting to have you feel uncomfortable.
No. It was writing my memoir was really something that my students asked me to do, and I really didn't really want to talk about this, but it was the healthiest thing and the most wonderful experience for me to do this sort of work. Mm-hmm. And so thank you for asking that question. I'm really grateful for that. It was for me sort of a disconnect. I always felt like the outsider until I actually met my spiritual family and went to India in 1985. I felt completely like a stranger in a strange land. I definitely couldn't connect with Bavaria, Germany. Felt like a foreign country to me. And what was really interesting was the language. The German language or the Bavarian dialect was really tough for me. Like at even very young age, after my coma, I knew I would speak someday, I would speak a different language, I would speak English. As if I had a different soul or something. I don't know what exactly happened, but I did talk about that in my memoir. I felt a disconnect, and I was looking for my teacher. I was looking for my spiritual teachers, my masters, gurus, whatever you want to call them. And actually, when I was 16 and my mother died suddenly, who was one of my greatest allies in life, I actually had left the Catholic Church. I had to write a letter to the Vatican in Rome and sign off. So that was a very difficult decision for me to make.
Wow.
And
I'm sorry, at 16 your mother died. Was it just sudden? Was she sick, or did you know what happened to her, or was it kind of swept away with her circumstance of her death?
Yes, I found her dead in the kitchen one morning, and it's really what prompted me to write this book was that particular story. It wasn't so much about my coma, but it was really the impact that made in my life of, and I'm very grateful for that too, is that, you know, I believe all circumstances that happen in our lives, no matter how bad they are, and we come into the ashes of life and we feel despair, like the things that just happened in Florida, you know, with the shooting.
And it's tragic.
A tragedy comes into our lives, and often we don't know how to pull out. And I had tremendous tragedy in my life that actually helped me embrace more of the light and use it so that I can I have a tool to help people that go through really difficult times in their lives. So
I imagine with what you experienced at 9, though there were parts of you that needed to kind of keep it undercover, can only imagine, and perhaps you can expand on this a little bit, that there was a part of you that also sensed and knew that there was something more to what was going on other than what we feel like we witness or experience here on Earth, that you saw something so much bigger, and perhaps that helped you deal with the death of your mother at the tender age of 16. And then subsequently leaving Bavaria. I wondered if you want to talk a little bit about that.
Yes, absolutely. I experienced a disconnect from my physical family, from my biological family. I felt that they were... I couldn't understand as a young girl why these external things like money and fancy cars and fancy houses and all these things were so important to them. That was the biggest thing. It's like the material consciousness was, I remember at 13 boycotting the petty bourgeois, you know, and wearing torn up jeans and torn t-shirts just so I could make a statement about all this external stuff doesn't make you happy, and it makes you actually miserable and imprisons you, you know, in working more and more and more and more and more and not really having any freedom. And I got really involved with art, and my grandfather had a tremendous influence on me and my friend Robert in Germany, who was an artist. And so I was just surrounding myself with artists and going to art classes and just trying to escape into the clouds or trying to escape into the tree. I remember drawing and painting a lot of trees all the time because it gave me that peace that I needed to survive in those days, you know.
Wow, how resourceful and resilient you were to find nature and to find art to be able to express and feel a sense, what I'm hearing you say is a sense of security, as if you could hide away somehow.
And I still use this today with my students. You know, when people come from the city and they haven't gone for a walk in years and years, or children that are growing up in inner city areas that never really know where a carrot is grown. And I just feel that it is so important that we help people see what nature brings to our hearts and the spiritual substance that is within nature, that is to be found within nature and not really on the TV and in the media stuff. Technology,
yeah.
You know, we're all so obsessed with it. So,
a lot of people, and especially our youth, have become very denatured in the different way, being denatured from their family, but being denatured from nature, not understanding or sensing into the interconnectedness and the vastness of the wisdom of the trees and mother and the four-legged and the two-legged. So what a profound gift that you received. I wonder what, as you were going through this, was your father present during the process, or was he...
I now understand my father much better than I did maybe as a teenager. Both my father and mother don't live anymore. But my father was intuitive. He wasn't intuitive, but he didn't know he was. So he felt everything so deeply that he had to suppress it with Bavarian beer.
So many. As a way to shut out the intuition is what
exactly.
You're saying, right? His sense. Were you able to talk to him?
No.
To him about your experience? No.
No, we had more of a telepathic connection. We had a connection that was much more intuitive. But later in life, he had a pretty strong disconnect from everyone and became very isolated and bitter, unfortunately. But that too was a blessing in my life, having to seek the father or the master or the guru or the, you know, the guides that I needed were people like Einstein and Kafka and Nietzsche, and, you know, people that were actual teachers. And so much of my influence as a very young teenager came from books and from studying the writers, authors of Germany and in that whole area, of that area. Like, one of the books that really had the biggest, most profound effect on me was Siddhartha by Hermann Hesse. So that book really saved my soul. So.
Wow.
It just strikes me as so many of the gifted ones, if they're raised in a family, especially, I imagine, within the German regime that you grew up in, of the gifts that get suppressed, and the beauty of the person that needs to go underground, and recognizing that your parents' protection of you to not say anything because you would be taken away or perhaps disappear, and out of their own fear can come the fear of the child that is also sensing it and having an experience that some could only dream of. So how has that been for you? I imagine you looking at your family, trusting that they were doing it out of protection of you, not necessarily that they wanted you to push it away, but rather to protect you, to keep you safe.
Oh, I believe that it's always from a place of protection towards the child, but it's also, in my mother's case, it was just a place of fear, being so controlled or dominated for so many centuries. I mean, this went on for centuries and centuries of the Catholic Church running the show, and it was pretty, you know, you couldn't really say anything outside of that. I remember when I went to India and I was initiated into Surat Shap Yoga, which is a science of light and sound, and I had a teacher in India for 11 years and meditated 10 hours a day. And when I came back for the first time from India and walked into my aunt's house, she didn't know how to deal with this. You know, this was like, oh my God, you're going to go to hell. You're definitely going to go to hell.
Wow. Yet still there was that soul part. Yet still there was that strong soul part of you that knew that this was the path that you needed to walk, regardless and irrespective of what others around you, especially your family of origin, felt. So.
And I mean, and whenever I attempted to speak about it with my aunts or my uncles, you know, it was like, we can't hear it, Petra. We can't talk about this. We cannot. We're not allowed to talk about this, you know. So, and I honor that. I honor that. And that's probably why I had to write this book, because nobody really in my family knows what happened in the last 30 years to this soul Petra that lives in the United States. Like, what was her life really like? What was she going through? Mm-hmm. Nobody knows. So maybe my cousins know more than my aunts and uncles, too.
So your hope in part with the books that are coming out is perhaps it will fall into their hands as well. Is that right, that they may get a sense and feel what it is that you're doing?
I'm not so sure if I need them to know what I'm doing. You know, as we get older, we have less of a desire for people to agree with us or approve of our lifestyle or whatever. I think it came out of an urgency of my students. Many of my students that have, you know, begged me for years and years to write my stories down, because some of them are so profound and they could maybe help people or inspire people. And so I did it from that place in my heart where I thought, gosh, you know, I can't really just sit on these stories. I should probably write them down. It's really not about me. It's about my students and the people that love me in this life. teaching tool for someone who's going through a hard time and thinks it's the end of the world, but it never really is, because we can change our reality. And my cousins are really upbeat. All my German cousins are super, super upbeat and all speak English, and I'm sure they all want a copy in English rather than in German. But if the book takes off and if it gets translated, it's going to be pretty fun. It's going to be some fun conversations with my aunts and uncles who are now in their 60s and 70s. So,
yeah, that's wonderful. And I thank you. Thank you again for putting into words and putting into print your experience and having the courage to do that. I want to ask you one thing. I've recognized from reading some of your bio that you left Bavaria and you moved to London, and that you experienced the Iranian Revolution of 78 and 79. What was that experience like for you?
Well, after my mother passed away, a year later, I went to London to study and became an au pair. That was a really glamorous thing to do at that time. And I ended up going to college one day and ran into a young, handsome, strapping, handsome Persian boy who then came up to me and talked to me, and I met him then later again in a concert. And 2 weeks after we met, the war in Iran broke out. The Shah of Persia was in exile, and Ayatollah Khomeini came in, and Fouad was his name, F-O-A-D. His father was one of the ministers in the Shah's army and was, of course, like so many of the people that were involved with the Shah, was thrown into jail and tortured severely. And being in London with all these Persian students who were now asked to turn their passports in, and that meant, you know, if you turn your passport in, then you're pretty much lost. You're going home. And I knew that if they sent Fouad home with his father in prison already and his mother a Baha'i, and the Baha'is were heavily hunted, that he would die because, you know, of the nature of his personality and everything else. He had a rock band in Iran during the Shah's time, and, you know, when the Shah was trying to turn Tehran into more of a Western city. And so he couldn't really handle all of the religious control that was being inflicted on everyone. So he and I went on a train to Munich, and I smuggled him across the border to get him into Germany, into safety, and was very involved in this war. And the interesting thing was Fouad's mom had to smuggle in a box of dried apricots the Baha'i seal that proved that her son was a Baha'i. And we then used that little seal, that little coin, and only the Baha'is had the seal, that if they had found that on the border, out these packages were coming out, she would have been killed for that. So she risked her life to smuggle this out of the country so that her son could live.
Wow.
And it allowed us to marry in the Baha'i faith, and he subsequently received religious asylum in London later on.
Wow. Mm-hmm. You know, I've noticed throughout our talk, I'm just very, very deeply touched with your story and your compassionate heart. It's so beautiful. And when I referenced earlier, you know, with, as you were talking about your family, you laughed a little bit. And I think the one thing that I'm really picking up is truly that joyous heart that you have with seeming like you're taking these experiences that could very well and may very well cripple others and cause others to fall to their knees and never get up again. And your resiliency is quite amazing. And for that, I just really applaud you and your courage and all that you do. and really see how this experience from the early near-death experience to finding your mother to leaving and being involved in the Iranian Revolution. What an amazing life you've led so far. It's an honor to be interviewing you.
Thank you so much.
And you're very welcome. And you've gotten involved in so many different areas, the Reiki and also the emotional processing. Could you talk a little bit about how, with your experience, do you tend to, because you've referred to your students, do you tend to work with your students in regards to your experience in the areas of resiliency, or are your students, you teach them Reiki and the emotional processing, which I would love to know more of what the emotional processing is that you're referring to. Whatever you would like to share with us.
Yeah, I have a meditation CD which I'll probably post on my website when it's done. I have my old website up right now, but in the next 3 days we'll have a brand new website where people can download the emotional processing golden light meditation for free. There's no charge. I give that away. And what I was introduced to emotional processing maybe 20 years ago when I lived in Mexico, and I was so out of my body. I was meditating more in the mystical type of meditations with the Indian masters and gurus. And while that was really wonderful, I was meditating so many hours a day that I became more and more sensitive to the world and was not grounded. I was not really connected here. I was just trying to get through life and grow old and so I could leave. And I always was thinking about, you know, how could I just speed this up a little bit and get out? And
yeah.
I had a child. I had a little boy, and my little boy needed me, and I needed to be present, and my partner needed me to be present. And I was introduced to this meditation. It's very simple. It's basically that between the ages of 0 to 7, we absorb everything from our peers, our mother, father, society. We download everything, all emotions. We're like sponges. And I always use this example with my students, like the little Trader Joe sponge. When you put water on it, it expands 20, 30 times. That's kind of how little kids are. So whatever is around them, they store it somewhere in their lungs or liver or heart or in the limbs, and that creates a great energy in the body. And I help people through guided meditation to know where that energy is, where it's blocked in the body, and how to move through it. So they really do all the work, and I use sometimes storytelling as to give examples, you know, for somebody that has something that is going on in their lives and try to just have compassion and help them through it through stories. And I find that to be really effective and powerful. So,
have you sensed that a lot of folks are, you know, there's many people who are speaking very spiritual and sometimes do what's called the spiritual bypass when they sometimes are not able to really resolve what's the trauma and things that have happened in their life, so they can speak spiritual jargon and meditate, as you said, for, you know, up to 10 hours a day with the meditating. It sounds like what your awareness did was it you recognized, and please correct me if this is not, that part of your work was to be present here on Earth, one, because you had a child, two, because you had a partner, and three, that's why we're here, is to be grounded and to do our work. And it's not time necessarily as much as some of us may have wanted to leave early, because it can be pretty harsh. The world as it is can be pretty harsh. That the students you work with, you teach them also who have gone through pretty explosive upbringings to stay and to know that it's safe to stay. Is that correct?
That is correct. Yes, indeed, indeed. And so many people that I've met on the spiritual path, and I mean by that, people that have spent lots of time in India, you know, then doing the mystical type of meditation or going into trance, etc. I see sometimes that, you know, while that is a beautiful, blissful state to be in, but then if something happens in physicality, then suddenly they completely lose it. And so I see that in the human aura or around people. I can see where the energy is stuck and then help them get into a more grounded space. And there's a difference between the white and the gold light. So that's why we do the emotional processing work with the golden light. And it's really powerful, and it's a good tool. And, you know, studying psychology for so many years, I know that talking about a problem does not sometimes solve the problem.
No, it doesn't. No, it doesn't. And we get very good at our story. And we often can have a million-page documentation on why we are as we are and not make any changes to it. So,
and that's right, Catherine, because now I don't have to tell my story anymore. I can just say, here's the book, read it.
Yeah, well, thank you. Thank you. And as we still have some time left, are there any areas that you would like to speak of that I haven't covered here yet?
Well, I feel that this is a time on our planet right now where we really need to gather more in groups.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to connect with people with, you know, different events and just music parties and things like that, and sitting around the bonfire and telling stories and just bringing community together. I think is very, very important. I'm right now sitting in Lake Oswego on the lake, floating on a what looks like a houseboat, but it's actually solid. And a minute ago, there was such a hail that came through here, and I thought, oh, my God, I'm glad we're solid on the lake, not floating. But, you know, I grew a garden out on my little deck. I have my tomato plants and my chives and my basil, and it gives me just that little bit of connection to nature when I can put my hands in the dirt and grow something. So
I didn't hear where you were. Where did you say you are?
I'm in Lake Oswego. I'm on the lake.
Lake Oswego. I just passed by there today. I left Oregon and I came back home to Whidbey. So I was in all the traffic, and I can imagine you in that beautiful lake. It's probably very tranquil there.
It's very nice.
It is a time that people are in so much fear, and as you alluded to yesterday's tragedy in Orlando and other tragedies where people seem to be singled out, and really the chaos and the mayhem and the fear that is so palpable right now. And wondered if you, for the listeners out there, with what you've experienced, especially I'll refer back to your near-death experience and what you saw, the sweetness and the tenderness and the love, if you can give tips or just thoughts for folks who may feel very heavy right now and very scared and maybe not be able to see that there is a divine plan. I believe that's unfolding at this point. Can you give our listeners anything maybe to hold on to?
Yes, I really would say to you, the listener out there, that when you feel despair and you feel fear, light a candle and sit with yourself with some soft music in the background, and maybe om or sing to yourself even, or sing along with a song, or go for a walk in nature. And know that all of this is really an illusion. There is a divine plan for everyone. There is a divine plan for this earth. There's a divine plan for us. And we can change our thoughts. So I think it was Wayne Dyer that said, if you change the way you look at things, the things you look at change.
Yeah.
And so we need to look at things differently.
Mm-hmm.
And so I choose, you can choose beauty and sweetness and softness and stay in that warm feeling in your heart and stay connected. And if you need someone around you that helps you get there, then call that person. Reach out, ask for help. Ask for help.
Thank you. And I wonder, you know, it is kind of crazy when one looks out into the United States in particular, since that's where we're at, with all the rhetoric and the words that are coming out of some people's mouths, which I won't mention any names, that can create more of the discord and more of the anxiety. And do you listen to the news, or do you tend to filter yourself from it, or do you listen to see where your emotional pulse is, and what is...
Well, I do listen to the news. You know, I'm definitely not one of those people that just shuts everything out and says, oh, I don't want to hear it, because I do like to know what's going on, and I certainly want to be... I watch the presidential debates and all this. I just find it very interesting in what's happening on our earth as a whole. You know, we're always put through stages. I look at it more... not just America, but I'm looking at it, being European, I look at it as what is going on the whole planet? What is really the theme here and what's happening? And where is our species, humans, where are we supposed to go next? So we are always offered choices, and we can either go right or left. We always have a choice. And right now, this is an invitation for all of us to evolve. And when it gets so dark and so heavy, that is where the key is, that we find the light behind it and realize, wait a minute, this may be an illusion. It just may not be gospel what they're saying here on TV. You know, maybe the media is not reporting this correctly, or maybe we're being told a lie. Maybe we need to ask some questions. And that's why I feel the gathering of people and playing music and being in nature is, you know, it sort of resets the clock in us.
It is really beautiful how I've noticed, because I listen to the radio, I listen to the news on the way up. It is really beautiful how people are coming together, not in retaliation, especially the folks who were within the community of Orlando, and others who across the country and across the nations, and with tragedies that have been happening, there has been such a sense of connection and of love and of light, and recognizing that to push up against the darkness with more darkness is not going to get us to where we want to go. Rather, it's the shining of the light and the gentleness of our soul. So there is definitely a movement happening, and to remember for the listeners to know that even it's darkest before the dawn, that there is so much wonderful, so many wonderful things that are happening now as a result of tragedy.
That,
if we're able to remove
so
remove ourselves from the drama, which a lot of people are very addicted to drama and very addicted to adrenaline and looking through their lens in a very small perspective. So as we're coming to a close, we have a few more minutes. Wondered if you would like to let our listeners know how to contact you. Also, you mentioned your beautiful gift of the Golden Light Meditation. Thank you so much for your generosity with that. Can you please direct our listeners to how they can go there?
Yes, thank you, Catherine. It's basically petranicole.com, petranicole.com. My new website will be up in the next 3 or 4 days, and then you'll be able to download the MP3 for the meditation. But right now, the old website is up, and it just has my picture and, you know, the books and all of that. So you can cruise around on the website. The meditation is not available there. But bear with me, and it'll be up. My webmaster promised he'll have it done. So I appreciate having this opportunity to speak with you today, Catherine, and to all the listeners out there, that hopefully you're inspired and feeling good today and healthy and happy and joyful. And I just wish everyone a fantastic Father's Day weekend. It's Father's Day on Sunday, so it's a big celebration. I will be celebrating all the fathers in my life.
Oh, that's beautiful. And I know, you know, you and I spoke briefly before this interview, and you had mentioned that you had not been interviewed before. I believe that's what you said. And I just want to really applaud you on how wonderful it was to interview you. And it's felt very much like you did an excellent job. And I look forward to have the opportunity perhaps to be able to meet you in person, and really appreciate all that you've been through and how you continue to again show up in life with such an open, gracious heart. So thank you, Petra,
for
your time today. Thank you. And dear listeners, thank you. Thank you. And dear listeners, thank you so much for listening in today. Again, you can, if you missed today's show, you can go to our archive show by going to blogtalk.com/authenticmessengers.com and go to our Facebook page, Authentic Messengers. If you would like to be considered as a co-author for another Spark series book, you can go to authenticmessengers.com for more information. And next week, as I mentioned earlier, every Tuesday at 3 p.m. Pacific time, I will be interviewing the authors from our Life Sparks book. Next week, June 21st, it's hard to believe it's already the 21st, I will be interviewing Susan Grief. Crossing Bridges will be the topic. And Susan says, we have all been faced with a bridge to cross. Whether we cross it or not is our choice. Sometimes our choices are determined by the negative talk embedded in our minds, creating a negative image that causes fear and anxiety. She shares her bridges, which she feared to cross till she found her passion and voice that empowered her to cross a bridge, which led to the joyous path of helping others deal with their trolls who live under their bridges that threaten them to cross to a more harvest pasture. So please do join us next week if you're available. Otherwise, please do archive our show. And with that, I wish you all a wonderful week and bless you all. Thank you, Petra.
Thank you. Thank you, Catherine.
Take care.
Geico presents sharing versus oversharing. Earlier this week, Claire Tippins shared a princess nickname generator, 3 pictures of her dog wearing a tutu, and 2 online quizzes, including, what candy is your dream castle made of? Claire, your sharing has tipped the sugar scale and turned into oversharing. But have no fear, princess. Geico has something worth sharing with your internet kingdom, like how you could save hundreds on your car insurance just by visiting geico.com. No magic wand required. Geico, 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
Hey, it's Flo, and this is my impression of a drill instructor directing a musical.
Town Hut! Get those tap heels in line and let me see those jazz hands! Are you bundling your home and auto insurance through Progressive? Can you hear me through those sequins?
Bundle your home and auto through Progressive and save.
Left, 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 and step ball change.
Progressive Casualty Insurance Company affiliates. Home insurance provided and serviced by other select insurers.